Hey guys, the following podcast is a Lady Gang Network and Podcast One production, which means it's going to be awesome. Welcome to The Stacks, a podcast about books and the people who read them. I am your host, Tracy Thomas, and today we have Acer Salmon. Acer is the author of The Wrong End of the Table, her mostly comedic memoir of growing up in the United States as a Muslim immigrant from Iraq and trying to find a place where she could fit in. Before we talk to Acer, let's do a little housekeeping. Here is your weekly reminder. In the show notes, there is a link. That link will take you to all the books discussed today, as well as the social media accounts for The Stacks and our guests. Plus, if you shop through the links on Amazon, you're helping to keep The Stacks free. If you're in need of a book recommendation, send us an email at askingthestacks@gmail.com. Myself and my guest will read it on air and give you a personalized book recommendation. So email askingthestacks@gmail.com with your name, what you're looking for, and maybe a few titles you've loved or hated. If you like The Stacks and want to support the work we're doing, here are a few easy ways you can help. First of all, you can join us on Patreon. You earn perks like our virtual book club and get to connect with other listeners of this podcast. Plus, you get to rest easy knowing your contribution helps to make this show possible. So head over to patreon.com/thestacks to be a part of this fantastic community. Another way to support the show is support our sponsors like Audible. They're your go-to destination for all things audiobooks. Plus, if you listen to this show, you get a free 30-day trial and a free audiobook download. So sign up at audibletrial.com/thestacks. The last thing is the easiest. Just subscribe to The Stacks. Leave us a rating and a review. It's super helpful and it's super easy. So please, please, please take a moment to do that. And of course, we always invite you to tell someone you know about the show. All right, that's it for me. Now it's time for our conversation with Acer Salmon. All right, you guys, I am here today with Acer Salmon. She is an author. Her book is called The Wrong End of the Table, a mostly comic memoir of a Muslim Arab American woman just trying to fit in. Acer also works in entertainment as an editor and a producer. Acer, welcome to The Stacks.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I'm so excited that you're here. We have a lot to talk about. Okay, so let's just dive in. Tell us a little bit about your backstory, who you are, where you came from, how you got to LA. It's just a casual intro. That's a lot of questions, I know.
Yeah, I'm like, well, how far do I go back? Well, my name is Acer Salmon. I am originally from Iraq. I grew up in Kentucky, and I came to LA after majoring in journalism in undergrad and deciding that I hated reporting on the news and I actually wanted to make up stories. Well, actually, I decided I wanted to do documentaries. And so I applied to film school and I came to Loyola Marymount, and that's how I got to LA. Prior to that, I think when I was a kid, like California was my dream because most of my life was spent watching TV, like a lot of young kids, but particularly immigrants watching TV and looking, you know, like, because you want to make sense of the world basically. So I was born in Iraq, came here when I was three to the States. So, just spent, and then we moved around a lot, Ohio and various neighborhoods in Kentucky. And then I kind of always felt like I didn't quite fit in. I always felt like the other. I mean, I am the other, but I always felt like I was at the wrong end of the table. Literally. Right. I mean, the reason I wrote the book is because I always felt like, and to this day, it's part that I'm, introvert, and part that the immigrant thing is constantly feeling like I'm at, you know, picture like a banquet table and there's a party going on, and there's always, for some reason, something more interesting happening at the other end of the table, to the point where I've gotten to choosing my seats. Like when everybody shows, I sit in the middle and then people sit away from me, you know, and I'm like, all right, well, so it's literally being at the wrong end of the table, but also feeling like as an immigrant, we feel like the other, because that's kind of more inclusive, like just kind of the non-majority of what America is, feeling like we're at the wrong end of the table, or maybe not even at the table.
Well, that's part of it. I mean, when I read the beginning of your book, and that's, you explain the title pretty much right away, I think in the introduction. Yeah. And I thought to myself, this is so right on. I feel this way, but I even feel that sometimes at like holiday dinners with my family. I know my brother and I were really intense. The rest of my family who's listening, plug your ears. I don't want to have to deal with this, but
we'll be like, okay, where are you sitting? Like, okay, let's put our drinks down here. So we already have our seats marked out. So we have to help my mom bring the food out. Nobody takes our seats at the table, which is very literal. But I think you're right to say that as the other, there's having a seat at the table and feeling like you're not in the right place, but also oftentimes not having a seat at the table.
Correct.
And that both of those things are true probably in different parts of your life, that sometimes you feel like you're looking in from the outside, and sometimes you probably feel more like, I'm here, but I'm not exactly where I'm supposed to be, or I'm not exactly where I want to be.
For sure.
I want to talk, before we talk about your book, I want to talk a little bit about producing, editing, what sort of work that entails, because I know that when I came to LA, I thought a producer was one thing, and apparently a producer is everything.
It is.
It's like if you're not acting or directing or writing,
right,
you're producing. And if you are producing, you also might be writing.
Correct.
Or directing or acting.
Right. So the kind of producing I do, it's called I'm a predator, which sounds horrible.
Yeah,
and especially
doesn't sound
when I tell you that the last big company I worked for is the Weinstein Company. So that right. kind of, you know, but it basically is a producer editor. And okay. what it is you know, I'm an editor, but I create the content. Okay. They'll give me the footage and just say, here, put something together. Okay. And they're like little mini document, like little docu featurettes, kind of behind the scenes stuff, you know, anything that promotes the film or show. And so, most recently I was fortunate to work on Pose both seasons, which was awesome. But that's basically, you know, when I came to film school, I was like, I never dreamed I would be a writer. I never really thought of myself as a writer. I guess I thought of myself as a storyteller, and which is more encompassing. But I did have the skill of editing. Even when I was a kid, I grew up, and so I forgot to mention also that part of in between Kentucky and California, there was a little brief stint of us when we lived in Saudi Arabia. My parents had jobs there, and so I lived there from when I was 9 to 15. And, there was not much in the way of entertainment. Right. And we didn't have like some of my friends who worked for like in Aramco and worked and lived in compounds. They had satellite TV, and that was the big thing. Again, bringing it all back to television.
Right.
And so there were two stations, and I would literally like edit, you know, bits together. Like I would on the fly record stuff and do these like interview things.
Oh my gosh.
And I was like, you know, oh, I'm just going to entertain myself. And I didn't realize that that was kind of the beginning of this career that I would have, that I would sort of fall into, that when I came out to, you know, I did it a little bit. I worked in news and I was an editor as well as a producer. And when I came out to film school, I thought, you know, while I'm waiting for my big break, my 3-picture deal, because I'm going to be a director and I'm going to win an Oscar and da-da-da, or an Emmy or whatever, I'll just edit. And I fell into, this was 2000. This was around the time of the DVD explosion, you know, where you were buying DVDs and,
right.
and here's what's happening behind the scenes. And this is, you know, here's Quentin Tarantino talks to the cat, you know, cat, whatever of this film. You know, so it was like kind of a look behind,
okay.
a look at, making of and the stuff that didn't make it to the screen. And so it's sort of like an insider look. And, I fell into that, like Miramax, I started, sorry, let me go back because I don't think so. That was happening. And I fell into Miramax and, fell into a job at Miramax. Well, I didn't literally fall into Miramax. I fell into Miramax and they're like, okay, we'll hire you. No, I just happened, to answer an ad for something and it was at Miramax.
Oh my gosh.
And, they'd wanted somebody to cut reels, and it became this thing where they would literally just give you footage and say, put it together. And it was at the height of Miramax. It was like anybody you talk to who worked there
right.
during the early 2000s, you know, that was the time. That's when the magic was happening. And
right.
so it was so exciting to be part of it. And so I thought, oh, okay, well, I'm working in my field, so I'll just stay. You know, I'm kind of making these little movies. I'm sort of being a filmmaker. And so I ended up staying for 17 years.
Oh my gosh.
As a freelance, because, you know, again, like editing pays well.
Well, and it's creative and you're still storytelling.
For
it's
sure.
just not necessarily, I think a lot of times when we're younger, we have dreams of jobs that maybe we want to have because they're the only ones we see.
Yeah.
So I don't know that kids anywhere, right. Saudi Arabia or yeah. Kentucky or California, even know that your job exists.
Right.
But they're doing what you were doing, which is splicing things yeah. together. You know, kids who don't know that you can be a producer on music, but you love to make a mixtape or something. You don't
sure.
know that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I'm sure that there's part of you that was like, this is actually way more fulfilling
yeah.
than I thought.
Well, and again, like the, I'll go back to the introvert and the awkward immigrant thing, you know, is that I could sit in a room and I didn't have to talk to anybody.
Right.
And I, you know, I'm not interacting with actors and I'm looking right. at them on this, you know, and I always, and I really credit editing with helping my writing and vice versa, because writing is the beginning part of telling a story mm-hmm. and editing is kind of the ending part where you're telling a story, you know, you're shaping it. And,
right.
and it's, you know, I also teach short film writing at my alma mater, Loyola. And I, you know, tell the students that, as some professor told me, that there's three movies you make. There's the one that you write, the one that you shoot, and then the one that you edit.
Mm.
And they're all going to be a little bit different. But yeah, I mean, we're not here to talk about my editing. I can geek out on that forever, because it's just super fun. Like, it's just, you know, you're yeah, like you said, you're telling stories, and you know, I'm one of those people that it doesn't bother me to play something over and over again. Mm. I know a lot of my friends are like, I couldn't do it. It would make me crazy. Listen to the same thing over and over. You kind of have to have sort of a little bit of a obsessive quality.
Personality.
Yeah.
Do you think that you'd ever try to write or direct or do something, or do you feel like you're in the right place for you? Like, do you like what you're doing?
I do. You know, I don't know that I would direct. Never say never, but I always feel like I definitely would like to have my own show on TV. I'm definitely
based on your life.
Correct. Yeah. I mean, and that's the thing. I came to this book, like I said, going back a little bit. So I was an editor, or have been an editor, producer, editor. And the good thing about that job is it allowed me to write as well, because it was, you know, I'm staring at a screen, but it's a different kind of screen. I'm staring at people, images, and then I can go home or on the weekends and sit down and write. And that's, you know, so I looked at it as, like you said, like a really great, a fun, well-paying day job. And at some point, maybe, I don't know, a few years in, I maybe 10 years into it or something, I said, oh, okay, this is great, but I want to create my own content. Mm. I don't want to work on other people's content, so I'm going to do my own writing. And again, I was so focused. I was thinking I would be a screenwriter, not TV, because at the time, even though I grew up with TV, but TV hadn't experienced that renaissance, you
right.
know? And I wrote my first pilot, which is called Those Kadam Arabs. And it was optioned, kind of made the rounds based on my life. You know, basically the theme of my stories is always this dysfunctional but lovable Arabic family. Who and the kid who desperately wants to escape, you know. And so this was a kind of a younger version of me, and very exaggerated. And you know, it just lent itself more to a television kind of serialized sort of situation.
Right.
And
well, you have so many stories.
So many stories, yes. Well, and that's the thing. Like, when I was younger, I was like, ugh, this is horrible. But you know, now when I started writing them, I'm like, okay, well, maybe this is the reason why. And my mother, you know, would joke with a big touch of seriousness that I was going to bring shame on the family, which I didn't. She's, you know, approved. She signed off on the book, and she's very happy with it. But in the beginning, I think there's that fear of like, what are you going to tell about us? And you're going to, you know, because especially like, you know, mothers are very, I don't know about your mother. My mom is very private. Don't ever, you know, don't speak outside the family, all that
right.
kind of thing. Little a Middle Eastern mom, you know, and then my mom on top of that is another layer. And it's just like, you know, don't say anything about anything, you know? And
right.
so I'm like, she's like, maybe you should just give, you know, a cousin and just make up a fake cousin and give her all the sex stories. And I'm like, mom, there's not going to be sex stories, you know, cause it's not that kind of book, but B, that's, you can't do that.
Your mom's like, why don't you write a fantasy novel
exactly.
about a made up
exactly.
woman?
Yeah, totally.
She'll Lacer. She's fine.
She's in outer space.
Yeah. She definitely is not from Iraq. She's definitely like, didn't grow up a lot of places.
Right.
Her parents don't do pharmacy. Like, no.
Yeah. No.
She's like, on Mars. It's fine.
Yeah. And she's blonde.
Yeah. She's definitely blonde. She's Christian and she's blonde. No big deal. Well, I do. Okay. You say in your book, when you're coming up, when you come to America, no one's ever even heard of Iraq. Like it's like totally, it's, you know, might as well be, I don't know, anywhere, a made up place
Mars.
For, especially for kids in Kentucky and Ohio,
right.
Like when you're coming up. And then of course, now so much of the focus in foreign policy, well, not right now. Right now, we're really focused on Russia and Ukraine, but I don't know, 6 weeks ago, so much of the focus has been on the Middle East.
Right.
How did that shift happen when you were still younger? Like the Cold War and all of that. I mean, not the Cold War, the Gulf War and all of that. You were here in America.
Right.
Like, how did that shift for you? And what do you feel like? What was that like? It's kind of a huge question.
Yeah, no, it was, so it was really, it was disconcerting. I talk about two, like the book is mostly comic, as you said, as the title said.
Yeah.
But there are a couple of, you know, serious points, and that was both the Gulf Wars and then 9/11, obviously. And I think it went, we came over in the 70s and people didn't know what Iraq was. And I think, you know, there was a point where I was at an ice skating rink with my dad, and my dad was speaking to me in Arabic, and a father and his child came by, and the kid's like, "Dad, what are they speaking? Where are they from?" And he's like, "I don't know, probably Mexican," you know, because that was the thing, right?
Right.
Nobody. And, I don't know. I think I was just so desperate to fit in that I was like, sure, I'll be whatever.
I'll be whatever's easy.
Yeah. I don't want, like, I don't know why it was such a, you know, scary thing for me to say, but also because we came here around the time of the Iran, you know, like the hostage.
Right.
And so there was that whole thing of like, oh, are you from Iran? You know, Iran and Iraq get confused and all that kind of thing. During the Gulf War, I was in college, and so it was an interesting thing because it was kind of, you know, my brother, it was that whole thing. Like, we were American citizens, so he could potentially be drafted. So it was this weird realm, right? That, you know, that whole thing. And then on top of it, like, you're in class with these people. You're, you know, who one of the women, I think, said something like, oh, God, why don't we just bomb them? You know, I remember I'd heard a lot of that in high school. Libya, the Libya crisis was going on. And so that was how, you know, why don't we just bomb that part of the world? And then you're just like, okay, these people are ignorant. But then you get to college and they're saying, you know, why don't we just bomb them? So then you ask, well, what's the story? Right. And they're like, and she's like, well, and it's obviously she had a personal interest in it. And her fiance was fighting over there. And if he gets killed, she's going to be, you know, and she's like, what are we doing? Why are we fighting? And so you kind of, it's that whole empathy thing. And always for me, always kind of leading with this, I'm here in America. I need to assimilate. I need to fit in. What is the right way to fit in? What am I supposed to, I was always that question of how am I supposed to feel?
Right.
And it's taken this long. I mean, that's why, you know, I don't know that we want to get, you have a question in the questionnaire, but like the very last question of what would you require Donald Trump to read? There's a section in the book that talks about Donald Trump and how he actually wasn't as horrific for the country in the sense that it allowed people like me to kind of push our voices louder, you know?
Right.
And I think that it's not until recently, this whole idea for me, this whole idea of authenticity and being who you are, there's no way you're supposed to be.
Right.
But back then I was like, I want to make it okay for you that I'm from Iraq.
And I want you to feel safe and comfortable around me because I'm not that, or that's not my family.
Yeah.
We don't have those beliefs
And so that's the thing, like you would get, and then around, you know, so then it became that whole thing. Well, you're not like them. Right. Or after 9/11, well, you're not like those people. And you learn, it's kind of like, I don't know how to, like, I'm working on a good analogy of it, but like not dealing with like accepting the scraps or just like divvying out, like, you know, I don't, like, maybe you can.
Well, you're saying that you're coming to terms with this idea that you don't have to accept other people's understanding of whether it's Muslim folks or Arab folks or whatever it is, that your wholeness isn't tied up in other people's misconceptions. Is that kind of?
Yeah. And also I think it's diminishing. Like I think if I look back at everything and I think, wow, I really diminished myself.
Right. Okay. I see.
You have to, but I kind of had to.
Right. It was a different time.
Different time.
It's hard. And I think you're smart to say what you said about Trump, not necessarily that, you know, he's done good for people or has helped people, you know, marginalized folks or, as you said, the other, mm-hmm. but that he has at least made it okay to talk about some of this stuff that we weren't talking about. Now, is the trade-off that maybe we wouldn't have to have like kids in cages at the border so that we could all talk about this? Like, it seems like a pretty shitty give and take, but I hear what you're saying about him. And I think that you're certainly not the first to say that. And I think a lot of people from marginalized groups have found their voice and their strength and have come to similar understandings of, I was doing things that were problematic or hurtful mm-hmm. to my own success.
Right.
In the past, and now I'm recognizing that I actually wasn't alone, or I didn't have to do that.
Yeah.
You know?
Right. And I think I just want to be clear, and it talks about it in the book, because my friend skewered me about this. She's like, you can't, are you really saying that Donald Trump is doing good for the country? And I'm like, no. What I'm saying is there is so much vitriol coming from a certain area that the other voices came out and went, all right, fine.
Right, exactly.
This is what we got. And it helped us as much as it was. We were worried that it was going to I was worried that it was going to divide us. It actually, I felt like, unified us. Or maybe I just, you know, you gravitate towards your people.
Yeah, and I think it
And by that, I don't mean my people, like my immigrant people. I mean like people who are like-minded.
Who
and,
share your spirit.
Yeah, so I don't want your listeners to be like, okay, they're like, what?
No, I hear what you're saying. It's not necessarily, it's just that he made space for some terrible, terrible dialogue.
Yeah.
And it allowed for people to actually respond to it.
Correct.
Where a lot of it was microaggressions or things that people made you feel like, oh.
Exactly.
Oh, you're making that up. That's not racist.
Right.
And
now I
can be like, don't you see that that's racist?
Yeah,
like, don't you see that that's anti-Muslim? Or don't you see, you know.
Right. Yeah, exactly. That's
and
a
it
great
also
way of
made
putting
space
it.
For people to run for office who have now become public figures mm-hmm. who we just wouldn't have seen, you know, like the freshmen, what do they call them? The squad.
The squad, yeah.
Like those women, are you kidding me? Those women were not going to be in Congress.
Right.
If it weren't for, so he's done terrible, terrible things, and I will not defend a single thing he's done, but I do understand what you're saying, that he's made space for other voices to come forward.
Right.
In your book, you tell it kind of through a bunch of little vignettes and stories about your life and stuff. Aside from your mom being worried, were you ever nervous or worried about telling your stories? Did you think
100%
I shouldn't do these?
Oh, 100%. In fact, well, for two, let me see if I can. Yes, to summarize, 100% I did. I felt like, for two reasons. A, I didn't think I had anything important to say to anybody other than my friends or people that knew me or a select group of people, because I thought, you know, to me, memoirs were about something serious, of people that did serious things. And, you know, mine was just a story.
Right.
But it all kind of changed. So as I was writing this, it all changed because it was started in 2016 and then it kind of, you know, was published just earlier this year. And so it became, the way I wrote it changed just because the world changed. And it allowed me, I felt a little bit better about it, talking to people and people were actually interested. Writing fiction, you can hide behind characters.
Right.
When you're writing as Acer, there's nowhere to hide. And, you know, I joke with my friends, I'm like, who's the guy that, Oprah, like, you know, basically reamed for making up, I think
James Fry.
Yeah, yeah.
Talk about him all the time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I love him.
I don't want to be like that guy. And I'm like, what if I'm on Oprah? That would ever happen. That would be amazing. But I don't want her to say, well, did this really happen, Acer? You know, like, what is this? And then all of a sudden, like, I mean, you know, I'm the outcast of the world. So there was that fear. And it's scary. But then again, once I embrace that, it's so liberating. And I found that I like the writing, like ideas that I maybe had thought were not really, oh, this isn't really going to fit, you know?
Right.
Because basically the through line of the book is me feeling like the other, me feeling like the outsider. And then I go to college and spoiler, there's a point in there where I realized I actually am kind of privileged in a way because I can pass. And I have spent my life trying to pass, right?
Right.
Whereas somebody who I had in college, I had an African-American roommate, she couldn't pass.
Right.
And I had no idea about that. Again, like that's why I'm like this more, you know, as I've gotten older and the whole idea of intersectionality and is just, it blows me away because I did not know her experience. I just knew my experience being an immigrant, being, you know, where you talk funny and you have a weird name, but at least walking down the street, I can, I don't know, just be a dark skinned, you know, American person or whatever, you know what I mean? Like,
or not, you could be like Italian,
not even,
or something.
Not even dark skinned. I'm sorry. Dark haired is what I'm saying. Light, you know, but yeah, Italian or Mexican or whatever.
Right.
And that was accepted. And it was, it kind of, I don't think that I would have come to that as quickly had I not been writing it as myself. And that's why I, you know, recommend to everybody, if you're not, even if you're not a memoir writer, you should just write it. Like write a memoir, you know, even if it's in your journal, because it really, you find yourself and then you're able to imbue that into fiction, fictional characters.
Right.
So
that's such good advice.
Yeah.
I love that. We're going to shift off your book. We're going to shift to your reading, but in between we do a little thing called Ask the Stacks. Someone has written in, they want book recommendations.
Okay.
So I'm going to read to you what they said, and then we're going to try to come up with some books for them. So this comes from Valeria, and I picked her specifically, this email, because we're reading Valeria Luiselli next week. So I thought, let me tie it in. Anyways, she says, I'm looking for book recommendations. I have recently read Stay With Me and The Stranger Beside Me, both of which I loved. I like alternating between fiction and nonfiction. I also have a 4-year-old, 3-year-old, and a 1-year-old. So looking for anything I can read between preschool drop-offs and pickups. Are you familiar with either of those books? So Stay With Me, I've not read, but it's a fiction book about a couple, and I believe the story has something to do with the wife can't get pregnant, and there's some sort of pregnancy drama. The other book, The Stranger Beside Me, are you familiar with that one? That's the Anne Rule. It's about when she was living like next door to Ted Bundy. So it's a true crime book.
Oh, okay.
I know. I was like, I don't know if she's going to be familiar with these. So it kind of feels like Valeria runs the spectrum. But what I'm hearing most from this email is that she wants something that's really going to be captivating to her because she wants to be able to pick it up and put it down and like stay with it.
Right.
So here's what I came up with for you, Valeria. We'll see. I don't know. We'll see. The first one is The Kite Rudder by Khalid Hosseini. Such a beautiful book. Yeah. It's so well written.
Intense.
It's really intense. I feel like Stay With Me kind of has that same kind of family sweeping narrative, readable. It's one of the best books I've read in the last lifetime, my lifetime. My next pick for you is Helter Skelter by Vincent Bugliosi. It's the story of the Manson murders. He was the prosecuting attorney. So the first half of the book is all about the Manson murders, and then the second half is all about the trial. I will say I love this book. It's one of my all-time faves, but some people think that it gets slow when it gets to the trial. So if you're not into trial procedural stuff, you might not love it. But I love it. And then the last one I have not read, but I'm reading it next. It's called Trick Mirror by Gia Tolentino. It's a book of essays about current pop culture, being a woman, being alive right now, social media, all of these things. And it's essays, so that might be really nice for you when you're doing pickup and drop off, because then you don't have to commit to the book. You can just read an essay at a time. So those are my picks. Does anything come to mind?
Well, I'm struck by the fact that you've recommended Helter Skelter between preschool pickups. Like,
that's well, she had The Stranger Beside Me, so I thought we could go true crime.
No. And you're probably right, because I would go, I don't know, like something maybe funny, because when you greet your child.
Yeah, I don't know.
No, no. You know what? I don't know what I would add to that is not the opposite of that.
Do opposite.
Okay. Well, I'm loving – so I love nonfiction because I love – and it kind of plays into the what you're talking – like the true crime kind of thing, because I feel like maybe the reason to read true crime and I don't because it gets into my psyche, but I feel like if I did, it would be because I want to understand why. So my lighter version of that is any Malcolm Gladwell book, because – it's like I'm reading right now What the Dog Saw.
Yeah.
And it's just interesting because, you know, he's so wonderful in that he makes everything into a narrative. And it's like, you know, so these like, you know, trends and things like that. Like he talks about the creation of women's hair color and the reason why Cesar Millan has been so popular with, you know, getting animals to
behave. The dog whisperer?
Yeah, okay. He's a dog whisperer because basically the title of the book is it's not what you're not, it's, you're not trying to, I think I'm going to butcher this, so I apologize, but it's not, you're not trying to get the dog to see what you want it to do. You want it, you want to see what the dog sees
right.
when you do the, you know, the motions and, or the, you know, the hand gestures and the, what is it? The,
I don't know.
Trying to train the dog. Anyway.
Yeah.
But so I love those and they're small, they're like chapters.
So yeah. They're essays kind of.
The other book I absolutely love is again, it's the kind of animal, I'm really into like animal thought behavior.
Okay.
The Soul of an Octopus.
Oh yeah.
I'm obsessed with the octopus because it's really the smartest animal.
I've heard a lot about this book and how amazing it is and so how good. Amazing octopus are.
Yeah.
That's
it's, you know, I thought it was octopi, but it's octopuses.
Yeah.
Because it's Greek.
Yeah, it's not what I know that the plural is not what I want it to be. So just say octopus.
Yeah,
and
the
just
octopus.
Just kind of like roll my eyes and pretend.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's just, I mean, I really, you know, you Google any like octopus trying to get out of it. I mean, they're super smart.
Right.
And they're finding now that like there's brains in their tentacles,
you know.
And so I've stopped. I mean, I used to at one point eat octopus and I'm like, nope, not gonna. But that's a really great book because again, it gets into like the idea, like what animals, you know, do animals think?
Right.
And all that kind of thing.
And those are so good. Those
am
are
I
good
supposed
recs.
To pick a third one?
No, no.
Let's leave. Yours are better.
No, no, no. I love your Malcolm Gladwell suggestions. Though, have you read his newest book?
Which is the newest?
Talking to Strangers. It just came out this year.
No.
Okay. When you read it, let me know what you thought.
Why?
Because I really like him.
Yeah.
I have read all of his books.
Uh-huh.
I listened to his podcast. And in the last, his podcast is maybe 3 or 4 seasons. I listened to every episode. In the last like year, he's kind of jumped the shark a little
really?
Bit. He's kind of,
how so?
I feel like he's riding on his intellectual capital and being like a smart person that uh-huh. we all agree is a smart person.
Right.
And I think in this book, he, in Talking to Strangers, he really, relies on that and does not rely on his storytelling and his argument making. And he tries to talk about a lot of really delicate social issues. For instance, the Stanford rape case, the Sandra Bland killing.
Yeah.
So he's talking about racism. He's talking about Larry Nassar, the gymnast guy.
Uh-huh.
And the guy who assaulted all the gymnasts. And he is not talking about it. He's talking about racism without talking about race. And he's talking about sexual assault without talking about power.
Uh-huh.
And he's trying to instead talk about how they're strangers and it's like a miscommunication. And it's like his argument is super duper flawed in this book,
mm-hmm.
but he relies on being Malcolm Gladwell. And it was one of my least favorite reading experiences of this year.
Mm-hmm.
But I normally love him. And so it's kind of been hard for me because listening to his podcast, was feeling like he kind of was moving in a direction I wasn't super into. It almost felt like he's been told you need to be talking about current events and really hot topics. And so he tried to force that into what he does instead of just doing his Malcolm Gladwell thing, which is normally picking really obscure examples and taking a point and like really spinning it finely, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, so I'll be interested to hear what you think.
Yeah.
Okay. Now to your reading. We always start here. 2 books you love, 1 book you hate.
I love The Importance of Being Earnest.
Okay.
Oscar Wilde. I just love the whole, I love slapstick and that you know, kind of mistaken identity. I just absolutely love it. French farce, even though it's not French. Where'd You Go, Bernadette?
Mm.
I love that. I saw the movie and, you know, it was good in its own right.
Is that with Kate Blanchett? Is it out?
Yeah. It came and went, unfortunately. I think a lot of maybe didn't get promote press.
And
it didn't really, people didn't. Like, I never understand what, anyway, it doesn't matter. But, okay. So, one book I hate, I don't know that I hated it, but I never really understood The Catcher in the Rye.
Oh my gosh. You're like only the 900th person to pick that.
I think again, like going back and I think like it's the required reading and I'm supposed to identify with this person, but I'm like, I have nothing in common with this person because I'm an Arab, you know, woman. And I found the main character really annoying.
Yeah. And that book comes up more than any other book on this podcast for either book you love or book you hate.
Really?
And I think maybe there's only been 10 episodes where it hasn't come up.
Can we? Okay, so then can you talk about like the demographics?
I can't quite. I think that mostly what it is if you read the book when you were 16.
Yeah.
And if you never reread it, and if you're white, and most of the time if you're male,
yeah,
you like the book.
Okay.
If you reread it, if you read it when you were 25 for the first time, yeah, if you read it and you're a brown person,
brown
if
person.
You read it and you're a woman, it doesn't always click. Though we have had some women who read it in high school and loved it, but yeah, mostly the hate comes from the other. And
yeah,
like I read it when I was like 22 and I was like, this is dumb, but I gotta go.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I think that's kind of what I've, like, those are the two camps.
Yeah.
But yeah.
And today, yeah, like, that's what I'm saying. Like back then I was like, oh, I'm not going to say that I did. But now I'm like, I can claim intersectionality as the reason I didn't, you know, it didn't resonate with me. I'm
right.
Like, well, it wasn't like, yeah, but brown people. I mean, that's.
I think yeah, that's oftentimes. That's fair. Okay. What are you, what's the last great book you read?
Let's say, Tell Me How It Ends.
Yeah.
Because we're going to talk.
We're going to talk about it. So
literally it's the last book I read and it's
a great book.
Pretty great book. Yeah.
Okay. What are you reading now?
I have a very bad habit of getting almost to the end of a book and then
stopping,
not with fiction,
okay,
but with nonfiction, like The Soul of an Octopus. I have gotten almost to the end.
Right.
So I could say that I'm currently reading that.
Will you finish it?
Yeah, I will.
Or is that not something that you do?
No, I don't know why. It's not a thing. Like a lot of my, you know, like what is the Woody Allen, like never reads the, no, Woody Allen would read the ending because he wanted to make sure it had a happy ending.
Oh.
In Annie Hall. No, some of my friends, like they don't want to ever read it because then it's finished and then they're
heard
sad.
That.
No, it's not a conscious thing that I do. I'm like, oh, shiny object. Oh, here's something else there. I don't know. this probably counts. One of the perks, I say, because this is my very first one that I've done. My agent is also the agent of Mara Gad, and her book, The Color of Love, just came out this Tuesday, the 12th of November.
Okay.
And I was able, you know, because I shared the agent, he asked me if I would write a blurb.
Awesome.
And I was so honored. And it's so amazing. She's a African American, she's mixed race, African American, Jewish.
Her like mother, me.
Yeah. Oh. Really?
Yeah.
I did not know. That's oh, you would love it. I have it in my, yeah, it's.
Oh, I have seen this.
Yeah. It's so great. And I, you know, so you always go into it wanting to read, you're like, okay, I'm going to like this because I have to do a blurb. And,
right.
But I loved it. And she is, so her, you know, she was put up for adoption and she was adopted by a Jewish family.
Oh.
And it's basically her relationship with her great aunt.
Got it.
And the kind of racism. And, you know, again, like this book, I wish it had existed when I was younger. But while I was, you know, dealing with like, you know, people not pronouncing my name or thinking I was Mexican, she was actually dealing with legit racism from her own family.
Right.
And I was like, wow, like you're a badass. So I really, I just finished this, you know, not too long ago. So, and I really love the book and it just came out. So
that's awesome. How do you pick the next book you're going to read if you're not blurbing it? Do you go with recommendations from friends? Are you reading Publishers Weekly? Like, where do you get your books from?
Mainly actually from a Bookstagram.
Okay.
Yeah. And literally from the cover.
I love Bookstagram. Bookstagram is such a beautiful place.
It's great. I did not know about it until my book came out.
I didn't know about it until I started doing the podcast.
Yeah.
And I was like, I guess I should create a social media account for my podcast that I haven't started yet.
Yeah.
And then I found all these people that are now my friends.
So great. Yeah.
And I just love it there. Yeah.
Yeah. And I always feel like, you know, they take such care to like craft, you know, the photo and the flowers and the coffee.
I know. Some of the people are just such amazing artists.
Yeah.
I'm blown away.
Yeah.
And then some of the people are really creative and smart writers and they write amazing reviews. And I kind of try to follow a mix of those people, but it's just,
I was humbled by the outpouring, you know, that happened when my book came out. I just, yeah. And it's really cool to, because they do very thoughtful, you know, reviews. Like, this is why I like the book. This is how it relates to my life. And, you know, you're like, oh, okay, cool.
Like, wow, thank
you.
Yeah, totally. I love that. That's awesome. Shout out Bookstagram. Look at you. What's a book that you really like to recommend to people?
Okay, so I'm a big Steve Martin fan.
Okay.
And I love his book, Pure. It's a little booklet. Pure Drivel. And he's a fantastic, first of all, he's an amazing playwright and he's a writer and he's written, you know, these novels. But this is just a book of, it's called Pure Drivel and it's like, I don't know, like, I don't have like not 100 pages and it's just nonsense. And it's just, again, I get back to that absurd thing. And it's just so funny. Like you can't, if you're having a bad day, you just pick it up and, you know, read it. So that's one book. I love My Family and Other Animals, which is Gerald Durrell. That's the reason he was a biologist and his family is in English and his family lived in Greece overseas. But again, it was that kind of spoke. It was like I was living in Saudi Arabia at the time, even though we weren't British. I just kind of, it's another dysfunctional, warm, loving family that I, you know, any, you know what, any book that has a dysfunctional family, I'm usually into. That's, yeah.
What's the last really good book that someone has recommended to you?
Well, I have to say, Tell Me How It Ends.
Yes.
Because
I love when it's me that recommends
that's right.
Are there any things that you wish were different about your reading?
That I actually did more of it. I wish I didn't get so distracted by the internet and I read more.
Truly, the internet is the worst thing that's happened to reading.
Yeah.
And the best.
And I don't read. I like to read hard. Cover, your paper. I want to hold the paper. I do listen to audiobooks because I found that it allows me to read more. When I'm at the gym or if I'm taking a hike or cleaning, you know, doing a mindless act. Like I feel like it helps. And for some reason, I absorb more when it's spoken to me.
That's so interesting.
Yeah.
So I think that I absorb better when I'm reading on the page because I think I get distracted by other things when I'm listening. And I've been listening to podcasts for a really long time. And so I'm really used to the way that podcasts function. So if a podcast is super narrative, I oftentimes don't like it because I'm more interested in a conversation than I am in storytelling audially.
Yeah.
Whatever. Yeah. There's a word there.
We'll get a word.
I've learned that a lot of people who are audio learners much prefer audiobooks because they retain much better than people like myself who are visual learners. Like when I read a book, I can tell you where on the page a thing was that was important to me.
Oh, that's
interesting. I can say like, oh, it was on like the left page, kind of high up.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, whatever. Or like I can tell you where the numbers are because I have a much more visual sense of learning.
Uh-huh.
And in my own personal, you know, self-centeredness, I never really thought about that other people learn other ways.
Sure.
You know, you learn that in school. Like you could be an audio learner, a visual learner, a tactile learner. But for people who learn through hearing, audiobooks are huge and they retain way more and they can listen to a million books and remember every little detail. Where for me, it's like if I listen to a fiction book on audio, I might as well not even listen. Like I just totally zone out. I can't stay with it, which is so weird.
That could be really cheap for you though because you could just listen to the same book over and over. I'm like, great, I listened to this book. And hey, I'm going to listen to this book again.
I do a lot of my audiobook listening through the library actually for that reason because I feel really guilty buying a book that I don't pay attention to. But listeners of this podcast, Audible is a sponsor here. So if you want a free 30-day trial at Audible, go to audibletrial.com/thestacks. Just saying.
I love Audible.
Yeah. I mean, it's a great service. I think if work listening to books works for you, it's amazing. Like, why would you not? I know people are shamed by it, but don't be.
Well, yeah. I mean, if people are ashamed, but let me tell you some things about, you know, that will make you feel better.
There's way more important things to feel shame about than listening to a book.
The fights that I get about how the movie was better than the book, that we can go into that.
I have that question. Okay. I'm going to make sure we talk about that.
But when I was a kid, I think I had, you have more time and I came in here with a big stack, like a bag of books that I love. When I would go to the library and literally like when I was a kid, like cock my head to the side and just like go down the aisles and like, okay, well that looks interesting. That looks interesting. And just grab all these books and disappear into my room. And I miss that. I miss being able to disappear. I think when I read, there's an impatience. Like I feel like I just want to get to the end and I don't savor it as much.
Yeah.
And that kind of bums me out a little bit. Yeah.
So you want to be more.
I want to have more time to be more thoughtful. Like, again, all these Bookstagram people are like, oh, I can't wait to curl up with a book. And I'm like, oh, I want to have that desire because I'm always like, oh, should be doing this. I should be doing that.
Right.
And it's not, you know, I'm not proud of that. So
I feel that. That's very relatable. What's a book that you feel proud about having read?
Okay, so I read The Fountainhead in 2 days, one Christmas break when I was at my parents' house.
Whoa.
And again, going back to that whole, I just want to know what happens kind of thing. And I was in college and it spoke to me and that whole idea of individuality. And so it changed my life. Or so I thought, you know, when you're young,
right, of course,
you're like, everything, I'm going to be a libertarian. And I'm not that it matters, but I think it was the first book of its kind that resonated, that, you know, struck me that way. And it could also be the fact that, you know, I went to school, I finished high school here in the States, but I was overseas from when I was 9 to 10, at 15. So that was like, I think I came here for 11th grade.
Okay.
So, but I found that most of the required reading was like between 9th grade and 10th grade. Over here. Am I not right?
I don't know.
Because they recommended Great Expectations over and over and over.
Oh, and I read that.
I love that book for that reason. But there was a lot of like horror short story stuff.
Huh.
But I feel like I didn't, you know, read a lot of the books that were recommended. And then you think, okay, I'm going to get to it. And like, you know, Catching the Rye. And you're like, this is what that was about? Yeah. But The Fountainhead, for some reason, I was like, whoa.
Was that school reading?
No,
for some people?
It wasn't. No, I thought, wasn't it?
Not for me.
Oh, okay.
But I grew up in the Bay Area.
Right.
So I don't know if that.
I don't know.
Ayn Rand is like, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know why it really, I think it was just, again, that I got sucked into it.
Right.
It was nothing. I know it's all political related, but I think the fact that I like this, coming from another country and this idea of individuality. That part of it resonated.
Really resonated.
So
that's great. I love that. Are there any books that you feel embarrassed that you still have not read?
Yes. Okay. So Hugh Laurie.
As she settles in.
Yes. Okay. So Hugh Laurie is one of my all-time idols.
The actor?
The actor.
But House or whatever.
House, yeah. Okay. But he's also an amazing musician. He has jazz album. And he's written... So he's written two books. This first one he wrote, called The Gunseller, a while ago. Like, he was still on House, I think, when it came out. And I bought it and I thought, oh, great. This is amazing. I'm going to read it. And it's basically kind of it's a parody of, it's an espionage sort of parody, a satire. And it's, you know, just, it's fun. It's clever. There's nothing, I don't know what my problem is. I have tried to read it. I've had this book for 10 years. I even went to England. I took it with me and I thought, okay, I'm going to sit in a cafe in this small, sleepy English town. And I still haven't finished it. And I'm really embarrassed. But you know what? Now that I've publicly claimed this,
yeah,
I'm going to finish it.
And you have to post your Bookstagram post about it. You did like a beautiful yes, shot of this
exactly.
book so everyone can see it.
So yeah, so that's a book that I'm embarrassed because I love him. I just think he is a genius and it's a good book. But for some reason,
you just can't get into it.
Sister can't get into it.
It's not working for you. I want to talk about the first book or some of the books where you feel like you saw yourself represented, mm-hmm. and specifically books about Muslim and or Arab and or Iraq. I'm curious because that's a kind of a blind spot in my reading.
Right.
There's a few books that I'm familiar with and I'm just curious kind of like what that was like for you, if there were books that you were like, wow. Mm-hmm. I'm here
right.
in these pages.
Well, I'm curious what the books were for you.
That I saw myself represented?
Oh, that yourself. Yeah, yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I feel like as far as like Black literature, there's a lot. So I feel like that's a good question. Someone should ask it on a podcast.
I just flipped it there.
I know you did flip it. I'm trying to think what books I felt like I saw myself represented. Well, I'm also Jewish, so I definitely remember being young and reading Number of the Stars with mm-hmm. my mom, mm-hmm. which is Lewis Lowry, and I really liked that book. Mm-hmm. That was about the Holocaust, which is also kind of crazy that I was into the Holocaust like as a child because that's very much still like in my interest.
Yeah.
Like terrible things.
Well, because it's fast, like the
whole
thing.
So
how could it have happened?
You right.
know, it's that.
Right. I'm trying to think what like stories of Black people where I saw myself reflected. Gosh, I've actually never really thought about this question for myself, if I'm being fully honest with you. Good. I'm stumped.
Well, it's easy to do because, you know,
it's so rare.
Yeah.
Like, okay, I do remember reading the autobiography of Malcolm X and thinking like, damn.
Yeah.
Like, what, like, Black people are awesome.
Right.
Though I don't know if I saw myself reflected in that.
Right.
But I definitely felt a connection to that part of me.
But do you think that's also a factor of the fact that maybe that book hasn't been written yet? Or yeah. It's being written now?
Well, I think there are books now that I've read, like, as an adult that I felt more connected to. Like, I recently read The Bluest Eye by Toni Morrison, like, last year. Uh-huh. And I definitely saw myself reflected back. But I don't necessarily think that it was a pivotal moment for me. And sure. I know some people do have that pivotal moment book where they feel themselves reflected back. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. Like, I remember really liking Matilda as a kid because mm-hmm. she liked to read. But, right. like, everything else about her was not me at all.
Right. Well, see, and that's the thing. Like, I think for me, the book, like, that's why I wrote that book, because right. I wanted it to exist when I was younger.
Right.
I wanted, you know, again, that sounds like a narcissistic
thing
to say, but it's, you know, it's that whole thing. Like, you go out and create what you don't see.
Right.
So for me, like I said earlier, My Family and Other Animals,
right.
the book, you know, because of it was never fully a whole book. So I think what I'm getting from you also, maybe we're thinking the same, is that it's aspects of things.
Yeah. Moments.
Right. Yeah. So, but the one that came closest to me was, Funny and Farsi by Fareza Dumas. Mm. It's a memoir of her growing up Iranian in America.
Right.
And, you know, it's just for me, like, it was close enough to my experience. And actually, I shouldn't say it closer than you would think, because my parents, my mother's side, my mother has, she's half Iranian as well.
Okay.
So, there's that. But yeah, the whole immigrant thing, the whole being from that region, you right. know, really, and it was the first time I was like, this is really funny. And it kind of gave me permission years later. Well, it gave me permission. Yeah. It gave me permission years later to write my own thing that wasn't a serious thing.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right. Totally.
But yeah, I think that's, but it's changing. What I'm loving about what I'm seeing out right now is, and what, you know, when I was writing this book, it was having to do the comps, you know,
right.
for it.
For people who don't know what that is, comps are basically other books that are similar to your book, and how those books, like how you could pitch your book basically right. is by saying it's a little bit of this and a little bit
right.
of that.
Right.
It's Funny Girl meets My Fair Lady.
Exactly. Yeah.
If you're a musical theater fan.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think like most of the book, like my thing was, it was less cultural and more funny. Like, Let's Pretend This Never Happened by Jenny Lawson. You know, she's white and from Texas, and she's right. hilarious. But it's that kind of awkward girl sort of thing.
Right.
So it's just, I think that's the thing is being, now that we're more, the world is smaller, if you will, you know, with all of, and there's so many good content coming out. There's so much good, you know, written content and, you know, on television, like I'm seeing myself on TV a lot more.
Right.
So I feel like there's going to be a lot more books that will allow me to connect.
And I think also just like, we're so much more focused on intersectionality now. Yeah. And a lot of books 100%. Where I saw myself represented in little moments
yeah.
weren't all the things.
Right.
Like, you could relate to this part of this book or this part of that book. And now I feel that there's being space made for people to write super specific narratives
yeah. Yeah.
that are not necessarily universal, right? Right? The universal story is kind of done.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, okay, we did universal. And exactly. by universal, you meant white guy. Right. Super not universal, but thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you for coming. Okay, before we get out of here, I definitely want to talk about, because you brought it up, movie, film, adaptation, better than the book, worse than the book.
Okay, so Silver Linings Playbook.
Oh,
I love that movie so much.
Okay.
It's so great. And I read the book.
I didn't even know it was a book.
Yeah, it's based on the guy's real life.
Okay.
And I think, I want to say Matthew Quick, his real, yeah. But it, I felt like, again, I'm going to preface this by saying it's weird. I'm a visual person. Mm-hmm. I like to take in visual, or I ascribe, you know, I remember visual, like images.
Right.
So this is not a knock on the book, but I felt like the main character was more, he was more sympathetic in the movie. In the book, I found him to be a little bit unlikable.
It's a Bradley Cooper character.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Where he's like this, you know, he's has mental, he's basically anxiety and all these problems that he's trying to work through.
Right.
He says he's been white knuckling it, you know, and then he finally, you know, gets the help and then meets somebody. And so, yeah. And David Russell is so great with like these little moments, you know, like these just little moments where, you know, they're kind of minor, like incidental moments that are great. And so I really loved that. I loved the Devil Wears Prada. Again, I felt like it was more realized. I felt like the book, I felt like on the page, the book was, she was kind of, I don't know, I want to say whiny.
Anne Hathaway character?
Yeah. But in the movie, I don't know. In the movie, she seemed, I had more empathy towards her. And of course, Meryl Streep.
Right. It helps. Just bumps your movie up.
Right. Like. Exactly. Just, you know. I almost got into a fight at a dinner party because.
Uh-oh. I'm so excited.
Because I told the guy that I basically said that season two of Game of Thrones was better than the book, that particular book was. And I, and just that particular season. I don't claim, like I started reading the books at season two. So I caught up and then, I don't think I read the very last one. So I'm only speaking about that one, but just the way they did this particular scene, and I tried to break it down, but he was not having
not
it.
Having
and
it.
He got mad. And so I always that becomes a joke. I'm like, okay, am I going to tank your dinner party? Cause
right. Are we talking Game of Thrones or not? That's so funny. Yeah. I'm always fascinated by if people have answers to that. A lot of the time it's hard because it's so often that the book is better than the movie.
Yeah.
Or the
TV
that's show.
Usually what it is.
Yeah.
And I'm the heathen that thinks that.
Well, sometimes it's better. Black Klansman was a way better movie.
Oh, I didn't.
Like so much
really?
Better. The book was pretty to me,
yeah.
Like pretty mediocre. And the movie I was really into.
I loved the movie. I saw it twice.
The movie's so good. Don't read the book if you like the movie.
Really?
That's my opinion.
What? No, so, okay, then, because again, I have my reasons and,
yeah.
you know, I'm.
I think that the guy whose story it is, Ron Stallworth, I think that he is wrapped up in some internalized racism, you know, anti-blackness. And so I think that that comes out in the book.
Got it.
And it's not quite as like, fuck the Klan. Like, it's not quite as.
It pulls punches?
The book, well, the movie is much more black power.
Sure, yeah.
Like, it's saying something. And the book is kind of more along the lines of, you know, they were in the Klan, but they were also nice guys.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's like that kind of thing where you're like, what are you doing? Why are we here? I hate this. I want to go. And it's not that well written. It's fine.
Right.
It's just a fine memoir. But I felt like the movie had a point.
Yeah.
That wasn't just,
right.
I infiltrated the Klan.
But do you think, okay, so here's the thing is I was talking to a friend of mine when I was telling her about, you know, coming on this podcast and like how I feel embarrassed that a lot of times I favor the movie or the show. Uh-huh. And she's like, yeah, all authors basically exploded all around the universe now for you saying that, you heathen. But do you think it's because like you're like, even though it's in your imagination, you, it kind of stopped, like it's more dimensional. Whereas.
Well, I don't know because I normally like the book more.
Yeah.
I guess, I don't know. I don't have a good answer, but I definitely think that, when a script is written from a book, if it's a good writer and a good director, you have a chance.
Right.
But I think that if the book is just amazing and someone tries to adapt
absolutely.
I think that's where the problem is.
Totally.
I think that if the director doesn't have a vision for what they want to do or why they want to tell this story, I think that's where you get screwed.
Yeah. We were taught in film school that I took an adaptation class and the professor said, it's very difficult to make a good movie off of a great book.
Right.
But it's really easy to make a good movie off of a crappy book.
I think that's true because I think then you can take it and make changes and make it make sense.
Right.
Whereas if you're trying to adapt something that's universally praised, people are just going to hate it because they already loved the book.
Right.
Okay, last question. Always the last question. If you could require the current president of the United States to read one book, what would it be?
What kind of grade level are we talking here?
You can decide. You can interpret this question. I always get – people always try to ask for clarification. Will he understand the book? Will he finish it? In my asking of the question, he will understand it. He will finish it. Will he take it into account in his policy in his life? I don't know.
Well, why don't we have him read Tell Me How It Ends?
Yeah. That would have been really helpful. I wish he'd read it, I don't know, before he was president.
Right.
But yes, Tell Me How It Ends. Okay, that's a great segue. Next week, we're talking about Tell Me How It Ends, an essay in 40 questions by Valeria Luiselli. It is a nonfiction book. It is super tiny. I'm going to say this to you. I said it to Acer when she asked me if she had to read the whole book. I said, yes. It's only 107 pages. The book is tiny. It's a one-day thing. It's a one-day or one-sitting type of situation. If you're a serious reader, it's definitely one sitting. You could do it in 5 days, but it's not a ton.
Or a two-hike thing.
It's a two-hike thing. Yeah, how long was the audiobook?
It's like an 2 hours, I think, or something
so
like that.
Yeah, so 2 hours. So you're good. If you haven't started it yet, you have the time. Please do. The book is amazing. We will talk about it next week in detail. It's nonfiction, so there won't be spoilers, but I recommend reading the book just because it's really special and magical in a devastating way. Acer's book is called The Wrong End of the Table, a mostly comic memoir of a Muslim Arab American woman just trying to fit in. It's out in the world. You can get it wherever you get your books. Acer, thank you so much for being here.
Pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And we will see you guys in the stacks. That's it for today. Thank you guys so much for listening, as always. And a huge thank you to Acer Salman for being our guest, as well as the folks at Skyhorse Publishing for sending over a copy of Acer's book. Find everything we discussed in today's episode in the link in the show notes. Get your book recommendation read on air by sending an email to askingthestacks@gmail.com. For more from The Stacks, follow us on social media at The Stacks Pod on Instagram and at The Stacks Pod _ on Twitter, and check out the website, thestackspodcast.com. To join The Stacks Pack and get inside access to this show, go to patreon.com/thestacks. Thanks to Audible, listeners of this podcast get a free 30-day trial and a free audiobook download by going to audibletrial.com/thestacks. Make sure you're subscribed to this show wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're listening through Apple Podcasts, please rate and review this show. Our graphic designer is Robin McCrite, and our theme music is from Tegirigis. This show was created and produced by me, Tracy Thomas.